Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 229. It's Monday, September 25th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's get right to it with a story that gets at some of what I call the pillars of health. This one's dealing explicitly with depression, but it covers a lot of ground. This from NPR. 7 daily habits can cut the risk of depression by 57%, a new study finds. A study of nearly 300,000 people in the UK found that people who maintained at least 5 of 7 healthy habits cut their risk of depression by 57%. If an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, here's a strategy that may help boost your mental health. Spend the next week observing your daily habits. You can jot them down in a journal to keep track. How well are you sleeping? How are you eating foods that nourish you? Do you make time for a favorite hobby or exercise? Did you gather with friends or loved ones? Your answers to these questions may help explain your mood and your risk of depression, too. In fact, a new study finds that people who maintain a broad range of healthy habits, from good sleep to physical activity to strong social connections, are significantly less likely to experience episodes of depression. Researchers used Mendelian randomization, using genetics to study behavior, to confirm a causal link between lifestyle and depression. They found a reduction in the risk of depression held up even among people who have genetic variants that make them more susceptible to depression. I think the biggest surprise is that if you have a favorable lifestyle, you can reduce the risk of getting depression by 57%. Which is really quite a massive amount, said study author Barbara Sahakian, a clinical psychologist and neuroscientist at the University of Cambridge. The study included data from nearly 300,000 people in the UK Biobank database initiative. Researchers identified 7 healthy habits and found that people who maintained most of them, 5 or more, cut their risk of depression by 57%. Researchers also analyzed markers of inflammation, including C-reactive protein, which is linked to depression, and found that healthy lifestyle was linked to better scores. C-reactive protein concentrations rise in response to inflammation. Of course, serious depression needs to be treated, and medications and therapy help many people feel better. But in recent years, as science has evolved, it has become clear that depression is not just a chemical imbalance. It's much more complex, and increasingly, a body of evidence points to the importance of habits and behaviors to help keep mental health strong. First up, number 1, the power of rest. This is definitely a pillar of health. At the top of the list is a good night's rest. Sleeping 7 to 9 hours per night, on average, reduced the risk of depression by about 22% in the study. A lot of us think of sleep as a kind of passive process, but it's an incredibly active process, Sahakian says. Not only does sleep enable us to consolidate memories, helping us remember what we've learned during the day, but research shows it plays a role in keeping our immune system strong. For instance, a well-rested person is better off at fending off the common cold. And though dreaming is still a bit of a mystery, the idea that dreams may help us regulate our emotions goes back decades. If you have insomnia or trouble sleeping, there's lots of evidence that strategies based on cognitive behavioral therapy help. Number 2, exercise is an elixir. There's a solid body of evidence linking physical activity to improved moods. A previous study based on data from the CDC found that people who exercise regularly report fewer days of bad mental health. And a recent meta-analysis found that physical activity was more effective than medications in reducing symptoms of depression. Antidepressant medicines tend to be faster in treating an episode of depression, says Douglas Nordsee, a psychiatrist with the Stanford Lifestyle Medicine Program. But physical exercise has more durable effects than an antidepressant does, he says. For some people, medication gives them a benefit in the beginning, but then it fades over time, Nordsee says. Whereas a lifestyle change can have a far more permanent and lasting effect. Nordsee and his colleagues use a range of evidence-based recommendations and tools, from medicines to therapy to behavioral approaches, including fitness, nutrition, sleep, and stress management, in order to help empower their patients. Number three, good nourishment is a necessity, another pillar of health. The researchers found that people who maintained a healthy pattern of eating were less likely to have an episode of depression. I always recommended the Mediterranean diet or the MIND diet, says Sahakian. Multiple studies show that a plant-forward approach that is full of greens, vegetables, berries, whole grains, lean proteins including beans, and healthy fats including nuts can help reduce the risk of disease. The MIND diet is a mashup of a Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet, which has been shown to reduce hypertension, diabetes, heart attack, and stroke. One study found that eating a salad each day is tied to sharper memory and slower cognitive decline among healthy seniors. And a randomized control trial found that college students who followed a Mediterranean diet improved their depression scores after 3 weeks, whereas depression scores among students who continued to eat lots of refined carbohydrates, ultra-processed foods, sugary snacks, and drinks remained higher. That is higher for depression. Steps 4 and 5, limit alcohol and don't smoke. Having a glass of wine or beer helps many people feel relaxed, but limiting alcohol consumption to 1 drink a day or less for women and 2 drinks a day or less for men is the recommendation in the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. People who regularly consume more than this amount have an increased risk of certain cancers and a higher risk of depression. Why? People think of alcohol as a pick-me-up, but actually alcohol is a central nervous system depressant that slows down brain activity. The more you drink, the more you chase the temporary high, which can increase the risk of dependence. There are lots of strategies to help people drink less, and increasingly, as the sober curious movement grows, there are people taking a break from drinking. And when it comes to smoking, there's loads of evidence that tobacco is not a healthy habit, and there are programs to help people quit, including medications, therapy, and smoke-free apps. And here in Ohio, I would add, for additional assistance, you can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's the Ohio Tobacco Quit Line. Habit 6, limit sedentary time by cutting back on screen time. At a time when cultural norms and the pull of technology are leading to more time in front of screens, there's growing evidence that this can harm our physical and mental health. Sedentary behavior is very bad, Sahakian says. Humans are meant to move, and though binge-watching your favorite streaming shows may be fun in the moment, if this behavior sets in as a daily habit, you're probably spending too much time on a sofa and not enough time interacting with people or moving. The rate of mental health problems is increasing in close correlation with the deterioration in lifestyle factors, Nordsee says. As helpful as smartphones and internet-based technologies are in making our lives convenient, it's common for people to sit for hours and hours playing video games or scrolling. We know that long periods of being sedentary are an independent risk factor for depression, independent from how much exercise you get, Nordsee says. So even if you go out for a 30-minute jog or bike ride every day, if you then spend most of the day in front of a screen, it can have a deleterious effect on your mental health. This is a particular concern for young people who spend a lot of time on social media. At a time when teenagers are facing high rates of depression, anxiety, and loneliness, there is mounting evidence that social media can exacerbate and even cause these problems. Here are some effective strategies to help people cut back on screen time, including scheduling a one-day break each week and turning off notifications, bells, and chimes so we feel less tethered to our devices. Habit 7, last but not least, cultivate friendships and social connections through hobbies. This may sound obvious, but spending time with people we like, especially when we're engaged in activities that we like, helps boost our mood. Another new study published in Nature Medicine, based on surveys of people in 16 countries, finds that people 65 and older who have hobbies report higher life satisfaction and less depression. Nordsee says people tend to know about the connections between crossword puzzles and the slowing of cognitive decline, but there's not as much awareness that hobbies, whether it's gardening, knitting, painting, playing games, or volunteering, can help boost your moods. As the authors of the study point out, hobbies involve imagination, novelty, creativity, relaxation, and stimulation. It's really nice to have a specific effect on mental health, Nordsee says in the new study. Hobbies really involve aspects of creativity engagement compared with the passive pursuits of watching TV or scrolling social media, he says. Whether it's knitting or playing bridge, hobbies that may be familiar to our grandparents, they keep us connected in ways that people have been connected over generations. The takeaway? Just as we can take steps to reduce our risk of chronic diseases, the research shows we can also take steps to reduce the risk of depression. And oftentimes, the same strategies that promote physical health are also good for our mental health. It's probably not possible to eliminate depression, which afflicts millions of Americans. Many people do improve with medicines and therapy, and now there's a growing body of evidence to show lifestyle medicine can help people alter their behaviors. I certainly see people who can effectively manage their symptoms with lifestyle interventions, Nordsee says. The key is for people to get the support they need to navigate change. And as I've reported before, depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide. So don't underestimate the frequency, prevalence, and seriousness of depression. And you can get a good head start by doing these 7 habits, some of the pillars of health that helps both physical and mental health. Okay, well, next up, let's do a little update on obesity prevalence. This from USA Today. Obesity rates in the U.S. just keep climbing. More than 4 in 10 Americans now fit the medical definition of having obesity, putting them at risk for serious health problems, including diabetes, heart disease, and some types of cancer. Recently released data from the CDC shows 22 states have adult obesity prevalence at or above 35%, compared to 19 states in 2021. Just 10 years ago, no state passed the 35% threshold of adult obesity, and now the entire nation is over 40%, yet a new record. And next up, let's go to some global health. This is also related to obesity rates, which are the highest in the world in the U.S. This from Medical Express. High blood pressure affects 1 in 3 adults worldwide, and most are not properly treated. The World Health Organization released its first ever report on the devastating global impact of high blood pressure, along with recommendations on the ways to win the race against this silent killer. The report shows approximately 4 out of every 5 people with hypertension are not adequately treated. But if countries can scale up coverage, 76 million deaths could be averted between now and 2050. Hypertension affects 1 in 3 adults worldwide. This common, deadly condition leads to stroke, heart attack, heart failure, kidney damage, and many other health problems. The number of people living with hypertension, that is blood pressure of 140 over 90 or higher, or taking medication for hypertension, doubled between 1990 and 2019, from 650 million to 1.3 billion worldwide. I would note that in the U.S. and some other countries, they've actually brought down the definition to 130 over 80, but this worldwide report uses the higher blood pressure measure of 140 over 90. Nearly half of people with hypertension globally are currently unaware of their condition. More than 3/4 of adults with hypertension live in low and middle-income countries. Older age and genetics can increase the risk for having blood pressure, but modifiable risk factors such as eating a high-salt diet, not being physically active, and drinking too much alcohol can also increase the risk of hypertension. And I would just add here that we often look at old age or perhaps genetics as being one of the driving causes. But if you look at indigenous populations, their blood pressure actually does not rise over age. In fact, it drops slightly in older ages. So it really is our environment. Lifestyle changes like eating a healthier diet, quitting tobacco, and being more active can help lower blood pressure. Some people may need medicines that can control hypertension effectively and prevent related complications. The prevention, early detection, and effective management of hypertension are among the most cost-effective interventions in healthcare and should be prioritized by countries as part of their national health benefit package offered at a primary care level. The economic benefits of improved hypertension treatment programs outweigh the cost by about 18 to 1. Well, I wish the U.S. had a national health benefit package. But that's not necessarily the case, obviously, being the only so-called industrialized country that doesn't have a national health program. Hypertension can be controlled effectively with simple, low-cost medication regimen, and yet only 1 in 5 people with hypertension have controlled it, said Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General. Hypertension control programs remain neglected, underprioritized, and vastly underfunded. Strengthening hypertension control must be part of every country's journey towards universal health coverage based on well-functioning, equitable, and resilient health systems built on a foundation of primary health care. So we suffer from both of those problems in this country. We don't have universal health coverage, and our primary health care system has been in decline in recent years. Okay, well, next up we have a story that's also related to heart health. This is from CBS News. Work stress can double men's risk of heart disease, study shows. Work-related stress is bad for more than just your mental health, especially if you're a man. While research has long shown that job strain can take a toll on workers' psychological and physical well-being, a new study finds that it actually increases men's risk for heart disease. Job stressors, including heavy workloads, tight deadlines, and environments that take autonomy away from workers, constitute job strain that's severe enough to hurt workers' heart health. Putting effort into a job where you don't feel you are appropriately rewarded, a predicament referred to as effort-reward imbalance, also has serious negative effects on heart health. Effort-reward imbalance occurs when employees invest high effort into their work, but they perceive the rewards they receive in return, such as salary, recognition, or job security, as insufficient or unequal to the effort, said lead author Matilda Lavigne Robichaud, a doctoral candidate in population health at Quebec University Laval Research Center. Male workers who experience either job strain or effort-reward imbalance were 49% more likely to have heart disease compared to men without those stressors, found the study published in the American Heart Association journal Circulation. Men in both job predicaments were twice as likely to have heart disease compared with men who did not experience the two stressors simultaneously. Job stress comparable to obesity. The negative health effects of job strain, coupled with effort-reward imbalance at work, are roughly equivalent to the effects of obesity on the risk of coronary heart disease, researchers found. Considering the significant amount of time people spend at work, understanding the relationship between work stressors and cardiovascular health is crucial for public health and workforce well-being. Our study highlights the pressing need to proactively address stressful working conditions to create healthier work environments that benefit employees and employers. The study is one of few that examines the compounded effects of job strain combined with other undesirable job attributes like low pay or little to no flexibility. Job strain refers to work environments where employees face a combination of high job demands and low control over their work. Researchers followed more than 6,400 white-collar workers in Canada without cardiovascular disease with an average age of 45 between the years 2000 and 2018. They measured levels of job strain and effort-reward imbalance relative to the incidence of heart disease. Results among women were inconclusive, the study found. Now, that last line there is a really interesting one. Normally, I'd be very skeptical of research that showed a huge difference, this doubling with both of those risk factors of stress. That would be gender-based. I mean, obviously, there are gender-based difference, but biologically, you wouldn't expect to have huge differences. Like, I think this is actually a social difference, and it's where stress in people's lives is centered. There's a gender divide there. For men, it seems to be more focused on their work life and work situation, whereas women, it's more the center of gravity of stress is driven more by household and relationship issues, in addition to work or occupational stresses. But the fact that the center of gravity, so to speak, is different in different places by gender would explain the differences here. I think there's a lot of research showing that work stress does affect cardiovascular disease, and this is another one to inform that, but also it shows that there are gender differences. But hey, everybody should have good working conditions, period. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and look at some social disruption that's causing firearm injuries. This is from Medical Express. Study finds firearm injuries increased in gentrified neighborhoods. Gentrification can have a ripple effect on communities. While it can improve certain conditions in typically low-income areas, rising housing costs can displace residents, causing social disruption and other downstream effects. Investigators from Brigham and Women's Hospital conducted a study using national data to examine the relationship between the rate of firearm injuries and gentrification. Their findings, published in JAMA Surgery, show that gentrified neighborhoods have a 62% higher firearm injury incidence rate than non-gentrified neighborhoods with comparable socioeconomic characteristics. They also found that neighborhoods undergoing the gentrification process experienced an additional 26% increase in firearm incidents compared to non-gentrifying neighborhoods. The process of social disruption and housing displacement due to gentrification puts people in the community in a high-stress environment, said lead author Sarah Beth Spitzer of the Brigham's Department of Surgery. The solution is complicated, but our findings reveal an opportunity to identify communities that may be at increased risk of firearm violence. Hopefully, this allows support and resources, such as community outreach and education programs, to target these areas and mitigate risk. So I'd never heard this one before, so that's interesting new research. Obviously, kind of overall social stress definitely leads to higher firearm injuries in the U.S., but this is particularly interesting since it really is talking about inequalities, where you have rising income and development, economic development in a particular neighborhood, which can bring some good things, but also brings stress enough to cause a substantial rise in firearm injuries. Yikes. Just one more reason to have equitable distribution of economic development and growth in communities. Okay, well, next up, as we've had several years of the COVID pandemic, we're seeing more and more research help delineate what the effects have been. And here's an interesting one from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Type 2 diabetes rates in U.S. youth rose 62% after COVID pandemic began. Rates of new onset type 2 diabetes climbed 62%, and type 1 diabetes increased 17% among U.S. youth after the COVID-19 pandemic began, especially in Black and Hispanic children, according to a study published in JAMA Network Open. Sociodemographic factors, average body mass index, fasting and random glucose levels, and hemoglobin A1C concentrations didn't change in the comparison period from 2016 to 2021. So it seems to be something a little different about the onset of diabetes, which points to COVID. And the authors noted that research has shown that coronavirus binding via angiotensin-converting enzyme 2, ACE2 receptors, damages islet cells in the pancreas and may lead to diabetes. So this is another just, you know, single point of looking at the kind of shotgun negative effects that COVID has on our physiology and our body. And youth are sort of the canary in the coal mine when you're looking at new onset of diabetes. That has been increasing, increasingly younger. The prevalence has been going up increasingly younger over the last decade or two. But this rapid rise during COVID shows that COVID infection is a major driver of diabetes in youth, which is just another reminder that we should pay attention to COVID. And on that note, we have this from The Hill. Biden administration relaunches free at-home COVID testing program. The Biden administration said last Wednesday it is relaunching a program that allows Americans to order free COVID-19 tests through the mail ahead of a potential surge of infections this winter. The website, covidtest.gov, relaunch new orders this Monday. Households will be able to order up to 4 tests, which are intended for use through the end of the year. So if you want to get your free 4 tests, just go to covidtest.gov. That's covidtest.gov. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up we have a story that gets at an interesting opportunity to improve the nutritional status of kids. This from Medical Express. Google could play a big role in protecting the health of American children. Applying Google's own nutrition advertising policy to the U.S. market would slash the number of products from the country's top 25 food and beverage manufacturers that could be marketed to children online, according to new research from the George Institute for Global Health. Published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, the findings suggest a global company could play a significant role in improving the health of future generations by reducing their exposure to and preference for unhealthy foods and drinks. Lead author Dr. Elizabeth Dunford, research fellow with the George Institute Food Policy Division, an adjunct assistant professor, Department of Nutrition at the University of North Carolina, said, "We know that relying on voluntary codes of practice leaves children exposed to the wild west of digital advertising, driving demand for unhealthy products that are fueling epidemics of obesity and other chronic diseases that will shorten our lives." Google's nutrient profiling model, which the company has already voluntarily applied in the EU and the UK markets, sets out nutritional criteria that a food or beverage must meet to be advertised to children through its Google Display Network, with products high in fat, sugar, and salt, such as donuts and pizzas, not meeting the threshold. The policy states that Google supports responsible advertising of food and beverages. The George Institute research team used the Google nutrient profiling model to profile over 14,000 products from the biggest food and beverage manufacturers in the U.S., including Coca-Cola, Danone, Kellogg, Kraft Heinz, Nestle, and Unilever. They found that only just over 2,500 or 18% of products, which were typically vegetables, fruit, and those low in fat, sugar, and salt, would still be eligible for advertising online to U.S. children under this policy. "We know that food marketing to children is pervasive and has been linked to increased preference for unhealthy food. Young people's exposure to digital marketing is particularly prevalent and is associated with poor diet-related health outcomes." Packaged foods and beverages comprise more than two-thirds of the average American's daily calorie intake, and foods and drinks, particularly less healthy products such as chocolate and sugar-sweetened beverages, are advertised online more frequently than any other product. In 2017 to 2020, almost one-fifth of U.S. children and adolescents aged 2 to 19-year-olds were living with obesity. Despite these escalating rates of diet-related diseases, there is currently no U.S. government-led effort to reduce children's exposure to unhealthy food marketing online, and existing food industry-led voluntary initiatives are known to be ineffective. Yeah, self-regulation doesn't always work that well. The World Health Organization has recently refreshed its calls for governments to introduce mandatory restrictions on the marketing of unhealthy foods to children globally. While supporting legislative action in the U.S., researchers from the George Institute for Global Health suggested policies like Google's could be implemented quickly as a useful first step. "We know they can do this and do it rapidly. They already have in other markets. We're calling on Google to put their money where their mouth is and use their power and influence for good in the country where they started," Dr. Dunford added. "The health of future generations of Americans is at stake." So this is great that we have this opportunity, but of course the opportunity is basically because of the larger context that we don't have any efforts to reduce exposure to unhealthy food marketing online of kids. We really need to do that. But in lieu of that, would be a good first step. Always asking those overpowerful social media companies to lend a hand. Make our society a touch better. Thank you, please. Well, next up, we switch to an area where the FDA has been trying to regulate and protect kids from harmful substances. This tobacco, in this case, this from CNN. FDA must do more to penalize retailers that illegally sell tobacco to kids, government review finds. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration needs to take a stronger stance against retailers that illegally sell tobacco products to children, according to a new report from the U.S. Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. The report says that the FDA didn't scrutinize repeat violators enough, and in some states, the agencies may have been disproportionately focused on sellers in only disadvantaged neighborhoods. The report also suggested that the FDA needs to do a better job overseeing online retailers and should work with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to help crack down on online sales to kids. The FDA stayed busy between 2010 and 2020, conducting more than a million inspections to look for underage sales and getting to about 74% of the 360,000 stores that sell tobacco products in the U.S. at least once. The report says inspectors almost always returned within a year if the first inspection found a violation. Despite all these efforts, youth tobacco use remains a high public health concern, the Office of Inspector General says. More than 3 million high school and middle school students said they had used a tobacco product in the previous month, according to a 2022 CDC report. E-cigarettes were a particularly big problem, with 14% of all high school students and over 3% of middle school students reporting current use in that survey. Under federal law, no one under 21 is allowed to buy tobacco products, let alone use them. Nearly 9 out of 10 adults who smoke cigarettes said they started smoking when they were kids, the CDC says. Although the overall number of people who smoke has been declining for decades, smoking is still the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. It can leave people with a lifetime of health conditions including lung and heart disease, cancer, eye problems, and immune system conditions like rheumatoid arthritis. Congress gave the FDA the ability to regulate the manufacturing, distribution, and marketing of tobacco in 2009, with inspections being a critical tool. To conduct them, the FDA sends out its own staff or contracts with a state or a third party. Most inspections are done by surprise, with underage buyers working undercover. Over half of states inspected 90% or more retailers that were in business as of 2020. About 10% of inspected stores had violations between 2019 and 2020, the report says. In cases such as these, the agency has several options. Most often, it sends a warning letter. The Office of Inspector General found that the FDA sent over 93,000 warning letters to first-time violators between 2010 and 2020. A letter is often all it takes for a retailer to become compliant, according to the report. But the FDA can also fine retailers that it finds selling tobacco to kids more than once. Penalties can increase with subsequent violations up to almost $13,000 for 6 violations in 48 months. In the time period covered in the report, the FDA issued almost 25,000 fines for repeat violations. However, not all stores pay the fines. Retailers with histories of violations pay only 9% of the civil money penalties in full. Those with fewer violations paid 60% of the penalties in full, the report found. For egregious violators, the FDA can also bar the sale of tobacco products, which means a big dent in profits, especially for convenience stores. The average convenience store makes about $1,000 a day from tobacco sales alone, according to the Office of Inspector General report. But only 204 stores were barred from selling tobacco, less than 1% of FDA inspection actions. The report says that responding effectively to serial violators remains a challenge for FDA. The small number of retailers that repeatedly violate the Tobacco Control Act are often not subjected to more punitive actions. This risks undermining FDA's efforts to control youth access to tobacco and enforce other restrictions on tobacco intended to safeguard public health, the report said. There's no set cycle in which the FDA will inspect certain stores, but the Office of Inspector General said the agency should prioritize and give greater weight to enforcement actions against retailers with histories of noncompliance issues. Inspectors in some states also seem to focus more on poor and minority neighborhoods rather than on stores that had a history of violations, the report says. Advocates for better tobacco control, particularly for kids, welcome the report. This underscores that FDA must do more to sharpen its enforcement work across the board, whether it's retailers, whether it's distributors, whether it's manufacturers or importers, said Erica Sward, Assistant Vice President of National Advocacy for the American Lung Association. FDA has better tools to use and they need to use them. Sward said the FDA has additional tools to keep kids away from tobacco that it's not using, such as ending the sale of menthol tobacco products and flavored cigars. In April 2022, the FDA announced it was going to ban popular menthol products and flavored cigars by August 2023, but the agency now says it will finalize the rules, quote, in coming months. Menthol flavoring masks the taste of tobacco, making it more attractive to new smokers, especially children, studies show. Flavored cigars and cigarillos also seem to be attractive to children, particularly black and Hispanic kids, who are twice as likely to smoke them as their white classmates. In 2020, more young people said they tried a flavored cigar every day than tried a cigarette, according to the FDA. So this enforcement, you know, they got to 90% of the stores and only 10% had a violation. Well, that may not seem like a whole lot, that even if you have 5 or 10% of stores where you can say reliably purchase underage, you know, kids are going to learn that very quickly. And you know how many tobacco outlets there are. So it's more than a chink in the armor. If 95% of the stores are actually compliant and 5% are not, that can be a big hole in preventing kids from getting access to tobacco enough for kids to walk to into a lifetime of nicotine addiction through tobacco use and all its ensuing health problems. Again, if you or a loved one is interested in quitting tobacco products, you can call the Ohio Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That is 1-800-QUIT-NOW for resources and help in quitting tobacco. Okay, well, let's move on to a couple healthcare stories. And, you know, health is a sector in general, broadly health, actually has a lot of nonprofit organizations involved in it. But if you're looking at pharmaceutical companies, it's almost unheard of to find nonprofit companies. We have a very for-profit driven healthcare and pharmaceutical industry. But here's a little break, a little chink in that armor. This from Medical Express. How new model boosts supply and lowers prices for generic drugs. Civica Rx, a not-for-profit drug manufacturer founded by 7 U.S. health systems and 3 philanthropic organizations, increased supply security and lowered cost on aggregate for 20 drug products, according to the first empirical evidence of Civica's impact published in the journal New England Journal of Medicine Catalyst. Results show that Civica was able to improve generic drug access above the wholesaler model, says the article. Chronic drug shortages have been an extremely challenging problem and elusive to sustainable improvements in the past. This makes these early results highly promising. Key breakthrough is structural rather than technological. The results of the study are very encouraging for patients and health systems, says Carter Dredge. The innovation of Civic is not technological, but rather structural. A new business model that injects a new type of supplier into a decades-old market for generic drugs in order to address a market failure. Market failures. Sounds like that's a whole bunch of landmines in our healthcare system. Civica is based on a new business model called a healthcare utility that prioritizes access over profit. It was founded in 2018 to address generic drug shortages and high prices that have plagued health systems in the U.S. and elsewhere, and now provides more than 75 critical medications at risk for shortages to U.S. health systems. Government intervention hasn't solved problems in cost and supply. Some problems in healthcare are so complex that traditional private sector or governmental interventions alone have not been able to solve the problems, that is, piecemeal interventions. Although competition increases quality and reduces the cost of goods and services across a wide spectrum of industries, healthcare seems intractably resistant to standard forms of competition, particularly in its hyper-specialized supply chains. Yes, if you control the whole supply chain, you have, in essence, a monopoly of sorts. New model sells drugs at same transparent price to all health systems. The healthcare utility model is governed by stewards rather than owned, and pricing is uniform for all customers in a bid to maximize access rather than profits. Civica members purchase Civica medications at the same transparent price as determined by the lowest appropriate cost necessary to sustainably provide the drug over a 5-year period. In conclusion, the authors say, the problems we face in healthcare are daunting, but many of them are solvable with the right approach. In learning from Civica's experience, some of the most fundamental answers may already be at our fingertips. This article provides the first empirical evidence that this approach is working. This is a welcome success in a more or less smaller piecemeal approach in our perverse incentive healthcare system. It's hard to actually succeed sometimes with a smaller approach. And this next article gets right to the heart of that. This from MedPage Today. Want better health outcomes? Check out what other countries do. How do other countries achieve better health outcomes in the U.S.? They all have 3 traits that the U.S. does not, Paul Keckley, Ph.D., said at the Population Health Colloquium here. Keckley, who is now a health consultant based in Nashville, Tennessee, recalled a time in 2009 during the Obama administration when he moderated discussions at the White House between various healthcare interest groups, including drug makers, health insurers, and device makers, about the best way to reform the U.S. healthcare system that would allow everyone to be covered while also reducing costs and improving quality. Every sector and subsector of healthcare has its piece figured out and thinks the others are the ones that don't really have religion, he said. But when White House officials studied the countries whose healthcare systems outperformed that of the U.S., three characteristics stood out. So pay attention. Here they are. Number one, the other countries had global budgets for healthcare. Those countries decided that there's a fixed amount of money we're going to spend, Keckley said. You think that's going to happen here? Not soon, anyways. Although I did report last week on they are running some Medicare experiments in the States about global budgeting for healthcare systems. So we're starting to see some experimentation with that. Second characteristic, the other countries had national standards of care. There was a standard of care that the government oversaw, he said. We don't have that. We let everybody determine what's appropriate care, and then we defend it. Characteristic three, the other countries made primary care the central form of care. However, there was a caveat to that, said Keckley. It wasn't about health or social services. It was about health and social services, funded directly by taxes at 2.5 times what we spend in the U.S. on social services, in which behavioral and physical medicine, prophylactic dentistry, and over-the-counter prescription drugs were integrated into those models of primary health care. That sounded pretty good to me, he said. Of course, this spending of 2.5 times on social services in other countries compared to the U.S., this gets at what I've long talked about social determinants, things like food and housing and transportation, things that a healthcare system can actually help deal with somewhat, although they also need to be dealt with in the larger society, and many of these other countries do a much better job that as well. But even in the formal healthcare system, they're spending 2.5 times of what we spend on social services. That would be an improvement. There is much cost-effective outcomes to be gained through that strategy, perhaps on the way to universal healthcare for all in the U.S.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, I want to close the regular reporting with a couple climate change stories on health. The first from Inside Climate News. Electrifying a fraction of vehicles in the lower Great Lakes could save over 1,000 lives annually, study suggests. New research reveals that even a mid-transition to electrified transportation could have outsized health and economic benefits for Black and Latino residents. Electrifying just 30% of all light and heavy-duty vehicles in the lower Great Lakes region could save more than 1,000 lives and more than $10 billion in healthcare costs per year, according to a study led by researchers at Northwestern University. And the benefits of the pollution reductions would be concentrated in disadvantaged communities that are disproportionately burdened by pollutant emissions from transportation. The study simulated and measured the potential environmental health impacts of electrifying a fraction of all vehicles on the road, including light and heavy-duty trucks, passenger cars, motorcycles, and buses in the lower Great Lakes region. The findings build on another study from the same research group released on September 5th that focused on heavy-duty vehicles. The earlier study found that although heavy-duty vehicles make up only 6% of all vehicles on the road, they count for approximately half of the lives and money saved if 30% of all vehicle miles traveled shifted to electric. The highest emission and pollution reductions were concentrated at transportation hubs, urban centers, and along highway corridors, where people of color are more likely to live. A shift to more emissions-free electricity sources in the power grid would save even more lives, according to the study. The study suggests that reducing air pollution burdens in environmental justice communities doesn't have to depend on hyper-local solutions like reducing traffic congestion or adding green infrastructure and trees in a neighborhood. Electrification of vehicles region-wide is one potential solution for addressing disparities in air pollution exposure. Good news. Let's get to it. Okay, and lastly, a little backsliding on air quality. This is in the New York Times. The reach of wildfire smoke is going global and undoing progress on clean air. On the heels of an exceptionally fiery and smoky summer, two new reports confirm that many Americans have already been seeing and breathing. Smoke from increasingly frequent, increasingly large fires has started to undo decades of hard-won gains in air quality, and the problem is expected to only get worse, not just in the United States, but also around the world. More than 2 billion people were exposed to at least a day of fire-related air pollution each year between 2010 and 2019, a report from researchers in Australia found. And in the United States, wildfires have undone about 25% of past progress in cleaning up air pollution in states from coast to coast. People have known that it's becoming a bigger issue in the western states, said Marissa Childs, a fellow at the Harvard University Center for the Environment and a co-author of the study that focused on the United States. But I was really shocked when we were running some of these estimates and see that states all the way to the East Coast were being influenced. While her paper doesn't include data from 2023, Dr. Childs said the wildfires in Canada and subsequent smoke over large swaths of the northern United States this year had shown more than ever that everyone is going to be affected by the growing problem of wildfires, no matter where they live. Together, the two studies showed how wildfires are a growing health threat. Wildfire smoke can contain a variety of pollutants, including fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, a type of air pollution made up of very small particles that can invade the lungs and bloodstream. Thanks to the Clean Air Act, air pollution in the United States has generally improved since the 1970s, but levels of PM2.5, which are routinely tracked by the EPA and had been declining, took a marked turn back up around 2016. Since 2016, wildfire smoke has had a statistically significant effect on PM2.5 trends in 35 out of the 48 continental states, according to Dr. Burke and Dr. Child's study. The effect was most notable on the West Coast, where air quality has worsened drastically in recent years. But even in some New England states, smoke caused pollution levels to plateau after many years of decline. Although the air is now cleaner in the United States than in many other parts of the world, air pollution remains a problem for public health. It's pretty clear that wildfire smoke is affecting a lot more people on a lot more days than it used to, said Christopher Tessem, a professor of environmental engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who researches air pollution but wasn't involved in either study. Globally, pollution from fires is taking a bigger toll on residents of poorer countries. The study that was led by scientists from Monash University in Australia found that in each year between 2010 and 2019, every person worldwide had an average of almost 10 days of wildfire smoke exposure. The concentration of polluted air was significantly higher in poorer countries. Smoke exposure between 2010 and 2019 was also higher than during the decade prior, and it underscores the prevalence of health risks of wildfires. Determining what approaches to use is going to be a complicated effort everywhere. It can't be done the way that we've dealt with, say, industrial pollution of cars, said Colleen Reed, professor of geography at the University of Colorado Boulder, who studies the health impacts of wildfires, but was not involved in either of the papers. There's not like a scrubber or a catalytic converter, some sort of technological thing you can put on a wildfire. While we work on policy solutions to try to deal with wildfires, we also can protect people's health by investing in better air quality in indoor spaces. Noting that it was important to make sure people knew how to protect themselves outside on smoky days by wearing masks or respirators, she also emphasized the importance of tackling climate change. In addition to all the policies to address wildfire smoke, obviously we need significant change to decrease our greenhouse gas emissions so we can try to deal with the climate side of the equation that's increasing wildfire risk. Amen to that. Okay, well, now we get to the last feature of the show, which is bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 23 bonus articles this week. First up, a healthy diet may lower dementia risk, even if you start late. More good news for a healthy diet. Of course, a healthy diet that's good for the heart is also good for the brain, since a lot of it is vascular related. Bonus article 2, loneliness needs to be treated like any other health condition. This is another one of those sort of, social determinants of health, and loneliness definitely causes as much health problems as a lot of other more traditional medical conditions. Bonus article 3, the quickest way to improve your family's mental health? Start talking, even about your mental health struggles. And that's particularly because mental health struggles often run in families. If a child has a mental health problem, they're more likely to have a parent who's had a mental health problem. And talking about that can actually help and even relieve some of those, the devastation of those conditions. This is a beautiful example of where some things that we see as a weakness, say a parent suffering from a mental health problem, can actually be leveraged into a strength. By talking about those conditions, it actually can help others in the family, such as the kids. Bonus article 4, redefining the non-communicable disease framework to incorporate oral diseases and sugar. So this is actually an article out of a journal, so it's a little erudite for some, but the gist of it is that oral diseases and dietary sugars have grown in prominence, the understanding of how it fits into non-communicable diseases, basically chronic diseases that we think of. Oral diseases don't tend to kill people, but they are very common and increasingly common. And a lot of that is driven by processed foods with a lot of sugars, which is increasing worldwide. And just the evidence showing that sugars themselves are responsible for a lot of ill health effects is begging that we consider oral diseases and sugars more into thinking about chronic disease. And another reminder about some things that are getting forgotten in our health, bonus article 5, when you think about your health, don't forget your eyes. So like dental, which often isn't included neatly in our healthcare system and health insurance, it's often true with the eyes. So what they say is, the things above the neck often get forgot, whether it's oral or mental health or vision health. Bonus article 6. In North Carolina, a radical experiment targets social determinants of health with fresh produce and safe housing. So North Carolina just expanded Medicaid in their state, one of the probably the last that'll do that. The remaining holdouts probably don't have a mechanism to do it because there isn't democracy and the people can't have ballot initiatives. But this is a good test project to show, which has already been proven in many test projects, that addressing social determinants of health such as diet and housing and such as things as transportation can actually help bring down the costs and improve the outcomes of our healthcare system. Bonus article 7, Biden to announce first ever federal office of gun violence prevention. Yeah, it's kind of surprising it hasn't happened, but hopefully this will bring increased focus on gun violence prevention, particularly since in the last couple years, gun violence has become the leading cause of killer of kids in this country. Tragic. Bonus article 8, Hep C's number comes up. Can Biden's five-year plan eliminate the longtime scourge? So I've reported a lot on Hep C, and since we've gotten good treatments in recent years, it just proves the point that having a good treatment doesn't necessarily mean people are going to get it. And there's been some progress, but it's been very truncated. A lot of people have not had access. And it looks like this five-year plan is another good step to get at it. Whether it can eliminate, that's another issue, but hopefully another good step to bring down hepatitis C. Bonus article 9, Medicare Advantage ads will look different this fall. So if you've been inundated by Medicare Advantage ads over the last year, particularly last fall during the open enrollment period, one thing you'll see, probably the main thing difference, is that they've tightened up the rules. You can't make it look like this is some like Medicare, you can't put a Medicare logo or a Medicare card or something on there. Most of these ads are actually individual companies trying to sell their own plans. And you don't have to take Medicare Advantage if you don't do anything, you'll just get Medicare, traditional Medicare, which is, in my opinion, a much better bet for the vast majority of people. Bonus Article 10, White House aims to scrub medical debt from people's credit scores, which could bring the rating for millions. So I've talked about this before, but it's happening. Bonus Article 11, brain drain, skills loss, and other unintended consequences of overturning Roe versus Wade. So as that ripples out into society, good read. Bonus Article 12, United States scores a C on global LGBTQ plus human rights scorecard and may be flunking soon, as 62% of countries are now flunking, not moving the right direction. 13, the Republican betrayal of PEPFAR, threatening a signature George W. Bush program and potentially killing millions with HIV/AIDS. Reported on this before, but this is a good Atlantic article covering it. 14. How will rural Americans fare during Medicare unwinding? Experts fear they're on their own. More tragedy for rural Americans, an already vulnerable population. 15. A black community in West Virginia sues the EPA to spur action on toxic air pollution. Good going. 16. As oceans warm, pathogenic bacteria are turning up more frequently in northern regions. And in more climate news, the Biden administration's next big climate decision, the liquefied natural gas buildout and fossil fuel exports challenge progress on global warming. Another good reading. 18. What the blah, 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 blah. Can't say that with the FTC rules. How to respond when your child swears. I include this just for a little bit different perspective. Is I think we should teach our children from a young age about the true obscenities in the world, one of those being runaway climate change. Bonus Article 19, nearly half of women with disabilities report experiencing sexual harassment or assault at work. Yikes. Bonus Article 20, only 2% of U.S. doctors are Latina, despite diversity leading to better care for patients. Good read. 21. Inside the gold rush to sell cheaper imitations of Ozempic weight loss drug. Selling weight loss has always been a popular thing, but there's some cheaper imitations that don't work as well, and Ozempic's got some question marks around it anyways. More warnings. 22. Melatonin warnings. Nearly half of parents give to their kids to help them sleep, but experts urge caution. Melatonin is, quote, not a regulated substance, doctor warns. And lastly, but not least, 23. Does the risk of getting long COVID increase each time you get reinfected? Short story, you've got a chance of getting long COVID every time you get infected. You can listen to these and other stories by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.